Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Book Network Global Affairs Channel. I'm your host, Matthew Rafferty. I'm here with Dr. Robert Peckham, professor of history at the University of Hong Kong and author of Epidemics in Modern Asia, published by the University of Cambridge Press. Welcome, Dr. Peckham.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about your background and how you came to focus on Asian history, and particularly the history of epidemics.
Well, I actually began as a historian of on the other side of Asia, so Western Asia, looking at the post-Ottoman world, the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, this enormous polity that stretched to the tip of the Arabian Peninsula and all that North Africa and a lot of Southeast Europe. And I became very interested in the degree to which sort of public health issues and disease were prominent in the archives. And that led me into thinking about the connections between the Eastern Mediterranean, West Asia, and other parts of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, with Mecca being one hub. So I became very interested in sort of connected histories and thinking about diseases as a way of broaching a kind of transnational history. Then I moved progressively towards East Asia, where I am now. And what came before this book was a project on the bubonic plague in the 19th century, the third plague pandemic, which hit Hong Kong in 1894 and then from Hong Kong spread globally to the United States, Australia, Africa, and obviously India, where it killed something in the region of 11 million people. And again, this was a way of thinking of empire in terms of these pathways of disease. So that's really the background to this book, an interest in transnational connected history, and a way of, if you like, rescuing history, in the words of Juara, from the nation. There's tended to be a focus on national histories of disease. And what gets lost, I think, there are these interesting cultural, social, political, and economic interconnections.
And was the work you were doing at the end of the Ottoman, was that your graduate study? And then it sort of led into these sort of larger and further eastern projects, or was that?
Yes, so it was. My PhD was looking at the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the emergence of nation states, and it's in the context of the state's role in managing epidemic control that I then became interested in thinking more explicitly about disease, rather than disease being just one aspect of state interest.
And to go sort of even further back, you know, how did you come to the study of history, you know, writ large? You know, was that an interest from early youth, or?
Yes, so I guess what I'm interested in is thinking about, and this is something quite prominent in Epidemics in Modern Asia, is the connection between history and the present. There's particularly studying diseases, there's a lot of pressure on history to have solutions or to have sort of answers for pressing contemporary issues. And of course, the relationship between history and the present is a complex one. So I guess very early on, I was sort of interested in parts of the world where the legacies of history have created a sort of political and social environment that continues to pose challenges. And so one of the interests very early on in this part of the world, i.e. the Eastern Mediterranean, the Middle East, was this was an interest in cultural interactions. That's sort of led me very much into the heart of the projects that I've been working on since on disease like epidemics in modern Asia.
Were these areas that you, you know, had an interest in? I mean, was there any sort of personal connection to the East or?
Yes. So I guess absolutely. So I have traveled a lot, and as a family, we used to travel to many places. So around the Middle East and in Asia. So, and obviously there's a very long connection with the subcontinent, Britain. So, you know, I was interested in traveling. I actually have a relative who was a fairly well-known Byzantinist called Stephen Runciman, who inspired me. He was interested in very much this area of what used to be called the Levant, the Eastern Mediterranean, Middle East. And it's through, you know, talking to people like that and traveling and thinking about these issues that I was sucked in and became absolutely preoccupied by this world. And through this world became interested in then following disease. And I'm interested in disease very much as a lens for thinking about bigger social, cultural, political issues. And I think that's why, I'm sort of cautious not being fitted into a narrow definition of the history of medicine or science or disease, because I see what I do is very much related to broader histories.
I think that's a sort of good segue into talking about this project in particular. To turn to epidemics in modern Asia, the first thing I'd like to discuss is the really, I think, impressive scope of the project. You know, not only are you dealing with a vast and complex physical area across different cultures, across different polities, but even just from the logistics of the project, you know, so many sources and so many languages and so many archives dealing with these different epidemics and different diseases. How do you sort of start approaching a project like that and finding a way to slice off useful chunks?
Well, first of all, this work is trying to bring together, synthesize a vast literature. And I'm very fortunate being at Hong Kong U that we have quite a focus on Eastern Asian science, medicine. So I can draw on the work and interactions with colleagues here, which is very, very important and useful. So one of the challenges and what I was trying to do is bring together these discrete bodies of literature and scholarship that don't often talk to each other. So there's a vast literature, for example, on India, the subcontinent. There's a growing and important literature in East Asia, and often they're not connected. And I think this is where, almost a decade studying empire in this part of the world was helpful. So what I've tried to do is to draw on my own archival research in the British Empire and then bring together and engage with this incredibly interesting and burgeoning literature on disease. One of the key themes in the book is thinking about what Asia is. So, I mean, the book raises as many questions as it answers. I'm trying to think about what Asia is. I'm trying to think about how history can work on different scales. One of the challenges for historians of epidemics is thinking about a problem that is on the one hand microscopic, i.e. bacteria or virus, and on the other hand, is population wide in terms of its impact demographically, etc. So how do we think on different scales? So I think these are very topical and important issues, given tensions and debates about the relationship between area studies, world history, global history, and latterly the notion of planetary history itself, i.e. the idea that we need to see human societies within a broader ecological view. So there's a kind of theoretical, methodological interest running through the book that I try to, if you like, bring to the fore through these five themes, which are mobility, cities, environment, and globalization.
I want to sort of delve into those themes and kind of how you came to them. But I actually, one of the things I was really struck with is you begin with a series of, I think, really sort of thoughtful and nuanced and complex definitions of the basic terms. You mentioned, right, one of the first things you have to do is define Asia.
Yes. Right.
But also, you know, defining disease, defining epidemic, right? Epidemic as opposed to pandemic, as opposed to endemic diseases. Defining modern, right? There's sort of not a single piece of even your brief title that doesn't need kind of some thoughtful explanation. And I'd like to sort of talk about that process of defining and particularly a term that seems to come up a lot that I found is really helpful, but I think, you know, might be useful to unpack a little bit, is the concept of translation. Right? You talk about sort of translating diseases across cultures, across political entities, right? That they're, you know, it's not just that their meaning is, or the epidemiology is understood differently in different cultures with different medical traditions, but even the meaning of what the disease is and what it portends is.
Yes. Yeah. So absolutely. So, I mean, I see the issue of translation is very important in thinking about epidemics, in part because when we retrospectively diagnose, we have to return to a vocabulary that is very different and appropriate that vocabulary into a modern vocabulary. So in other words, different cultures in different times have different words for diseases that have symptoms that we could perhaps recognize as, say, cholera. But of course, that entails a kind of process of what I call translation. In some contexts, as in Japan, where Chinese concepts from medical thinking are being translated into Japanese. That's a much more conscious process. So I think that this idea of translation is at the heart of what I'm thinking about, and I see it as related to this idea of cross-border mobility. So the issue that I'm really trying to explore is not only how disease, i.e. biological agents, move across borders, but how interpretative systems, languages that describe them also move, and in moving they adapt. And I see the nearest way of explaining that is a kind of translational process.
I'd also like to kind of have you take us through the book's five kind of central themes a little bit, because it's I think it's a very interesting approach, right? You don't go, I mean, very intentionally, because of, I think, what you're trying to accomplish here, you don't go region by region, or, you know, subregion by subregion, or disease by disease, or chronologically across time. You've got these large themes that you explore in a number of ways. And I'd love it if you could pull those out for us a little bit and kind of, you know, maybe take each one in turn.
So I'm actually interested in how epidemics are produced, and looking at the entanglement of biology, the social, the political, and the economic. And I use the five categories as lenses in, as approaches to that central problem of entanglement. And essentially what I'm trying to think about is how disease is produced by transformations that are social, economic, and political. At the same time, it itself, an epidemic, can have impacts that then loop back to affect those the social and the political and the economic, etc. So it's that relationship that I'm exploring through these five different concepts. So, I mean, yes, so the first one, mobility, I'm interested in thinking about Asia in this connected way. There's a very interesting literature that I guess from the last 10 years, particularly looking at the idea of circulations and circulations in terms of trade, in terms of movements of people. Obviously, for example, the Chinese impact on a lot of Southeast Asia is very profound. The impact in Southeast Asia also of subcontinental culture. So there's a very interesting circulatory history that I wanted to explore in relation to disease. So that was a very that came very naturally out of the work that I've been doing on MPAR. So that was mobility. Interesting. I was interested in thinking about urbanization, partly because where I live, which is Hong Kong on the Pearl River Delta, has essentially experienced this extraordinary experiment in urban living with the Pearl River urban agglomeration, you know, in excess of 40 million people. And the kinds of environmental challenges it poses, the kinds of social transformations and the economic realities. And thinking of all of those transformations historically and the rise of big port cities across Asia. So that very much linked to this idea of transnational circulation, the rise of these cities. And disease becomes a very interesting way of thinking about the ways in which cities are predicated on certain kinds of transformations. And that led very naturally to thinking about the kinds of environmental changes that have happened in Asia. You take an aeroplane and fly over Borneo, for example, and you look down and you see the kinds of plantations being cut out of the rainforest. And, you know, one of the features in Southeast Asia and across Asia is this incredible transformation. And I was interested in thinking that historically and looking at it as a driver of new emerging infections and so that again was part of this interest in the biological, the social, the political, and the economic. War again is interesting from a point of view of scale. I was interested in thinking about how different kinds of conflict have driven disease. So looking at sort of, full battlefield kinds of conflicts to civil wars and to insurgencies and to colonization itself thought of as war in terms of the US and the Philippines. And again, looking at disease as a way of thinking about what war means and the scales of war, and how war has become entangled with public health operations to prevent and manage disease. And again, you know, I wanted to think about globalization through the lens of disease. A lot has been written about how a global interconnectedness has driven disease. And I wanted to think about how the kinds of economic transformations that have happened, particularly in Asia since the 1980s and late 1970s, could actually shed new light on how we think about globalization. So I guess in what I'm trying to do is not only think about Asia, but think about these very, very essential categories and to show how disease and disease in Asia can actually bring a new dimension to how we think about these.
I think that there's an interesting way in which that sort of progression through from thinking about mobility to thinking about cities and the changing urban environment to thinking about the environment, you know, sort of all of the environmental changes or the connection between epidemics and the environmental changes and then war and globalization is also a really nice way to rethink and recast and retell the story of modern Asia from the rise of colonial empires to the anti-colonial moment to the creation of post-colonial states, nation states in Asia, without it just being that kind of imperial to national narrative.
I think you're absolutely right, and that's one of the problems. I think there's a very rich literature on empire, particularly sort of European and to a lesser extent US involvement in Philippines. So there's a big imperial literature, which tends to, I think, dominate the historiography on disease in Asia. So what I was interested in doing is resituating empire within a much more complex environment. So thinking about Japan, thinking about China, and thinking about sort of the plurality of imperial formations. And in fact, one of the things that I was trying to do was to look at the sort of unevenness of political sovereignty. That if we take a map and you see these sort of monochrome, colors on the map that identify different imperial spaces, seen through the lens of managing diseases, those spaces become much more heterogeneous, much more ragged and uneven. So I think, yes, one of the projects is rethinking empire in a sense. One could make a grand claim like this idea of provincializing Europe, the Chakrabarti idea. In other words, to de-emphasize to a certain extent the notion of empire being the preeminent polity in Asia, the Western Empire. If one takes the Dutch East Indies, for example, it's fascinating the extent to which, the sovereignty didn't extend in an even way over all the myriad islands that they nominally controlled. So I think it is an interesting way of, rethinking empire.
And I think related to that, there's also the economic or sort of the history of capitalism aspect to this, right? The sort of the disruptions and the expansions and the reordering of humans on the map to serve growing networks of trade and production that almost necessarily has enormous consequences for those populations among those is what happens with disease.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, for example, in the section on environment, looking at the birth of these enormous industrial plantation complexes, which are, on one hand, it's an environmental story of how a landscape is altered for capitalist industrial production. But on the other hand, it's a very human story, where millions of laborers are shipped in to work on those plantations. And so there's a transformation happening not only in the destination where those workers are going and the kinds of health issues that they confront, but also in the places they're coming from. So I think that, the story of the environment but then becomes a story of social change. And it's that entanglement that I'm interested in looking at. And it's afterlife in contemporary Asia. So, we spoke a little bit about why I became interested in history. I'm interested in thinking about the complex links between the historical past and the present that has been shaped by forces of the past. And obviously that linkage is complex. So it isn't an easy thing to attribute aspects of the present in a linear way to the past, but thinking about that. And I think that particularly in an issue like infectious diseases, which remains a critical security issue globally, I think there's a lot of pressure on historians to formulate some sort of argument about why history matters.
And yet, you know, also kind of avoid the, you know, I think some of the danger of global or kind of multinational regional histories like this is sometimes they are asked to serve too tidily. It's either a kind of empire was bad kind of moral claim.
Yes.
Or alternately, the older kind of, you know, triumphalist story, you know, dealing with these topics, especially, it's got to be particularly important and particularly challenging to avoid the kind of Asia as a site of infection, as a quote unquote hotspot on the one hand,
yes,
both historically and in the modern era, but also avoid the kind of celebratory march of Western medicine reaching eastward and, you know, taming backward people and backward practices and all that kind of problematic language that is still, I think, especially to historians' ears and eyes, kind of alarmingly still present in some of these sort of global histories and the history of medicine in particular.
I think that you put it very well. I think that's exactly right. This idea of Western technology that disseminates from the metropole and Asia being a site that receives it and is transformed by it. But I think that you know, what's interesting and heartening, I think there's been a very interesting scholarship looking at medicine, say, in India, medicine in China, looking at the complex co-production of Western and indigenous healing practices to show that it's a far more complex dynamic than one of, you know, center-periphery imposition, deposition of a local, you know, local institutions of medicine, etc. But I think the point you make about the triumphalist historiography on empire is important. And then the flip side of that, seeing empire, you know, as a sort of demonic force that crushes everything. And instead, what I tried to do in this book is to resituate empire to show its coexistence with a plurality of other kinds of regimes. So that hopefully it can retextualize that story of, you know, triumphal empire. I think that the other thing in the history of epidemics and disease, from the 70s and 60s, you got very interesting global histories. They tended to be Atlantic histories. So Crosby and others. But what's interesting in global histories of disease, Asia tends to be a very marginal part of that global story. So you're absolutely right. Asia tends to be the places that from which diseases emerge. And then what historians seem to be most interested in is their impact, say, with cholera in Europe and North America. But of course, cholera in the 19th century had a huge impact on Asia itself. So really, I was trying to recalibrate that story and place Asia at the center of how we think about disease. Recognizing, as you put it, the challenge that you could end up replicating the story of Asia as a hotspot. So, you know, one has to grapple with the fact that, you know, for example, where I live is particularly vulnerable to emerging infectious disease. And there's a reason why that is. So without sort of denying that sort of reality, to explore the complexities of how they've been imagined is what I tried to do in this story.
Yeah, I think that sort of brings to mind the really interesting sort of backs and forths. I'm thinking about the one anecdote in there that actually where Gandhi is speaking about. It's sort of giving a critique of the railroad, right? Not as a mark of progress, but as mechanism of disruption and a harbinger of disease.
Yes. Yes.
You know, that the technologies coming from the West are also, you know, part of the disruption and part of these vectors, even if they're also part of, at least in the Western imagination, you know, the solution, the civilization, the cure, at least in kind of the 19th century high imperial sense.
That, I mean, that's something that really interests me, the idea that, you know, the technologies that are developed with one purpose end up having these countervailing effects that call for new technologies in order to deal with the problems that they're causing. And particularly in the bubonic plague, which is, you know, this construct of the plague as a kind of medieval ancient disease. And I was interested in thinking about modernity in relation to this sort of this aura of the ancient disease, and thinking about precisely these circuits, like the railway, like steamships, etc., that were actually driving this disease. Part of the story is precisely this, that the so-called tools of empire ended up in working in reverse, if you like, and exacerbating problems. One could tell a different story. We could tell the same story through a different technology, like the telegraph system. So the telegraph system, on the one hand, provides them for the management of crisis in empire, but at the same time, it provides these conduits for panic that can undermine the very purpose that they were imagined for. And it's these kinds of contradictions and countervailing forces that I'm sort of interested in exploring in the context of India with these sort of modern tools like railway, etc.
And even the less physical technologies. I'm very interested in the parts where you talk about kind of technologies of control and surveillance and how they're built often out of these crises. Not just in Asia, but also back, back in Europe and elsewhere, they're thinking about sort of the disease as an important prompt or, sort of providing the necessary crisis to create and expand modern state bureaucracies, whether those are imperial or post-imperial and national. And I was struck by kind of the – and also in the way cities are ordered and organized and used and traveled through and understood. I was struck by – and I'm going to get the two cities wrong, but there was a comparison in here that in some ways Manchester is as much an imperial city or sort of a project of empire in its order and construction as Mumbai.
Yes. So, I mean, the notion of crisis is very, I think, central to this book, exploring what a crisis is and the idea of an epidemic as a crisis that provides opportunities, for the state, for example, to move in and expand its remit and impose policies that it wouldn't be able to do in non-crisis time.
The old cynical saying of never let a crisis go to waste.
Exactly. But then at the same time, thinking about the ways in which crisis then undermines state authority. So there's two ways, and the dynamic is complex between crises and political authority. But then thinking, about what a crisis is and about the ways in which the crisis can actually skew our way of thinking about history, so that we only see the crisis moments and we don't see the non-crisis moments. And it's something that Janet Reutemann in her book Anti-Crisis raises. Is it possible to do history, a non-crisis history, to write a non-crisis history? Are we inevitably always going to write about crisis? So one of the tensions in the history of disease is that obviously a lot of diseases And this goes back to the issue of endemic and epidemic. A lot of diseases are background sounds. You know, they're a constant in a population. And then epidemics are moments where that disease is framed in a particular way. And so I'm interested in how disease episodes can be framed as crisis, perhaps with a political reason, with a rationale and a motivation. So I think you're absolutely right to identify crisis as an important defining category in this book. And what, you know, one can move it to contemporary world where some diseases suddenly gain a visibility. So if you take Zika, for example, it suddenly becomes visible, and yet it's apparent that it has been around a very long time. Dengue fever, I have a student working on a history of dengue fever in Asia, has a long history, but it somehow hasn't gained the visibility that other mosquito-borne diseases like malaria have gained. So there's an issue about why some diseases become visible, why the state mobilizes around certain diseases rather than other diseases, why some episodes become crisis and others don't become crisis. Part of the interest in the book is exploring how that happens.
Do you think it's useful to think of those in terms of kind of moral panic, where it's the state response or the sense of crisis in a population is uncoupled in a way from the actual threat? So, you know, some diseases, people shrug and say, well, you know, it is thus and has always been thus. And others, you know, one person sneezes and everybody freaks out, or the state.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, I'm really interested in the kind of disproportionate responses with quarantine and limiting of mobility and things like that for some of these outbreaks and diseases, where others, you know, it's either too important that trade continue or labor move, or it simply doesn't catch the imagination, sort of instill the same kind of fear. That too kind of culturally and moment specific to say anything more general about that, or is that, or is there something that makes, you know, what makes a disease, you know, go viral if you in the worst recycling of a.
So that's a very interesting question. And I actually edited a book called Empires of Panic, which looks at the history of panic and how panic is produced. I think it's a very important issue. What I feel is that panic is often a compound. These are compounded crises. So in the case of, say, Hong Kong and during the plague, in 1894, there's a biological threat from plague, but then there are anxieties over a colonial community versus an overwhelmingly Chinese population. There are worries about economics and trade, etc. So when all of these come together, they produce panic. So it's a kind of compounded notion of crisis. But I think that what's interesting is the ways in which different kinds of panic sort of are co-produced. So in the case of an epidemic happening, often governments panic in their response, perhaps anticipating panic in local populations. And then local populations may panic, creating again this loop back into government response. So the idea that panic is something that ill-informed people do, i.e., native populations, rather than governments, is a fiction, and so it's really, really tracing these convoluted processes of panic. And of course, I think new technologies like the telegraph and later radio and telephone and radio become means for the circulation. I mean, after all, when East Asia is linked to capital markets like London, and it takes, you know, 52 minutes from Hong Kong to London, a crisis in Asia can alter markets in London and New York. So there's then a transnational panic happens. And I think you start to see that at the end of the 19th century with influenza pandemics that are global that can go around the world in 4 months, and they produce this, different kinds of panics. So I think panic is a very important part of what you were talking about, crisis and the visibility of a disease. And often the disease crisis turns out not to be, in fact, about disease, but to be about fears of trade or mobilities of people, etc. So when we look at crises happening around the world today, I think, whether it's refugee migration issues, they've compounded their issues there that are political, economic, and also disease figures as one of the anxieties, if you like.
I think that there's it's really interesting the way that as you said, these can kind of compound the fear of the disease can sort of topple markets. The fear of, the other, a racially distinct population can create fantasies of disease, and fear of disease at the first sign, right? And
yes,
the kind of racial or cultural or kind of moral quarantining that goes on that doesn't always match very well with the not just the level of threat, but even the kind of actual lines of the vectors of disease.
Yes, and I think that's where we get into the sort of cultural context, the ways in which, this othering, the ways in which certain communities are identified as disease carriers. And of course, much of the book is about a world that is pre-biomedicine, where a lot of the disease entities weren't understood. And so in that context, stigmatizing becomes a way of attributing agency, and in a sense, understanding the disease and offering a solution to a problem. So absolutely, I'm interested in the sort of cultural aspects of quarantining in particular. And there's a very strong, I think, geographical spatial dimension to the book. It's very concerned with different spaces, be it spaces that are inside these kind of radical interventions, the spaces of that are the spaces of quarantine, boundaries, transgressions, translations. So it's a kind of spatial history in one sense.
And that, I think, that ties in also with this, the not just sort of the movement, spatial in the sense of things moving around or things being defined by place, but also you have an argument in here about the importance of disease and epidemic in developing kind of conceptions of citizenship and identity in the newer nation states.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in the way in which ideas of rights to health, the right to health, and the idea of being a good citizen entails being healthy, and looking at these ideas as they work in East Asian societies. And of course, a radical example of that is China under Mao, and the ways in which, populations were mobilized in the fight against disease. So this idea, I think, is very closely connected. In Europe, it's one of the aspects that comes out of the French Revolution, I guess, right? The centrality of health, and the beginnings of a notion that the state has an obligation in providing health for its citizens, and reciprocally, that the citizens have an obligation to lead healthy lives in order to sustain the state. So I'm interested in thinking about state citizenship, again, through the lens of disease and its obverse, which is health.
To ask a far more sort of less lofty and less academic question, which of these diseases freaks you out the most? So in other words,
I suppose it would be one of the hemorrhagic diseases like Ebola. I think that
so fast, so catastrophic.
I mean, and what's interesting about Ebola is, you know, the degree to which there are many aspects of it that we still don't understand. So yes, I would say a hemorrhagic disease like Ebola, you know, a viral disease like that. It's interesting. I think that we face, you know, huge challenge in dealing with these diseases, and I think Ebola is a great example. In fact, one of the things I'm now thinking about in a new project is precisely the kinds of surveillance technologies, you know, that are developing in order to preempt disease outbreaks.
And that's probably a good place to go here is to think about, or, you know, to ask you about what is coming next.
So there are two projects I'm working on that very much relate to this. One is the history of surveillance technology, which essentially I'm interested in tracking how communication technologies from the telegraph, the telephone, radio, and then onwards to the world of the internet, how these have been co-opted into disease surveillance, and using case studies to shed light on communication and surveillance. And so I recently completed a piece on looking at satellite technology, which is interesting that during the Ebola crisis, satellite high-resolution imagery was very critical to managing the humanitarian or medical crisis on the ground, but also in thinking about the specific hotspots that were likely, where Ebola was likely to emerge as a problem. And it's interesting that a lot of literature has been devoted to on-the-ground surveillance, but actually relatively little has been written about the implications of surveillance going spatial. In other words, that we have to look up to see the structure of how space is being organized, and who owns it and who's involved. So I'm interested, again, in a transhistorical project that tracks the evolution of communication technology in relation to disease surveillance. And then another project, I'm actually very fortunate in going on a sabbatical where I'll be spending a year at NYU, and that's a project looking at the Eastern Mediterranean as a critical zone in its relation with Asia. And again, sort of in the sense returning to where I started this whole thinking on disease, is looking at different disease episodes as windows into thinking about Europe and Asia in what is now, I think, re-emerging post the Ottoman Pact's disintegration in Iraq and Syria as a very important place for, again, challenging how we think about states, the state's role in managing crises. So the two interrelated projects that both very much focused on thinking about social political processes through disease. And I see them as extensions of the kinds of thinking that's going on in epidemics in modern Asia.
And I think that's probably a good place to start to come to a close, since that's a research agenda that probably is so substantive that you need to get back to work immediately. but I do want to thank you so much for talking with me and talking about this project with the New Book Network. And the book is Epidemics in Modern Asia. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Matthew.